We interrupt this program for a news bulletin. A black family has moved into Meadow Park, and this has created a near riot. Many angry whites have gathered at the home. That's all the information we have at this time, so stay tuned for more information.
How do you do, John Ebar, Crusader?
What is the name of your organization?
Black Front of Unity.
You'll never live in that house in peace. I'll burn it down myself before I let you live in this community. Get your black hands off of me!
Suppose I could make you indestructible.
Our tactics are strictly defensive. I mean, we wouldn't foolishly invite the pigs to shoot us down.
Hey, Dick! Look like Abar's on a trip!
Preach on, Brother Ebar.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to The Projection Booth. This is Mike Amando Justin, and we're here with our second episode where we discuss Ebar, the first black Superman. Also known as In Your Face, this film from 1977 was actually filmed in 1974 by the one-time director Frank Packard, written by the one-time screenwriter James Smalley, and starring the one-time actor J. Walter Smith as Dr. Kincaid. But, more importantly, it stars Tobar Mayo as Ebar, who is the first black Superman.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I could have swore that another alternate title for the film was Super Black.
That was one of the titles when it was originally bandied about, back when Tobar was going to have to wear a lime green suit with a big SB on the chest. So I'm very delighted that we had a chance to sit down with Mr. Mayo, and I think we should probably start off the whole show with that this week. So let's go ahead and play this interview with Tobar Mayo. So how on earth did you get the nickname Tobar?
Well, that was from, I think it was from one of my best friends, actually. I don't know if you remember or not, but there was an elephant named Tobar in the elementary school books years, a long time ago. I don't know if they still do it or not, have it or not, but it was about an elephant. And so at the time, I was tall, but I was skinny. But he always kept saying I was going to grow into a Tobar. And I didn't know what he was talking about at first.
I was curious if you could tell me a little bit about a film on your resume called The Mislaid Genie.
Oh, man. That was a porno film. It was, wasn't hardcore, but I was shocked that that was on. That was never, ever on my resume. It was a comedy. We did it in 1970. Oh, man, it was funny. I played the genie, and it was about a guy who's, the opening scene is about a guy sitting on in the tub taking a bath, okay? Starts to play with himself, and poof, instead of coming out of the lamp, all this smoke comes up, and I jump into the scene, you know, just dressed like a genie and doing the old yawn thing. I've been asleep, and of course, I give him three wishes, and all he wants to do is have sex, of course. And it was simulated, though. So I give him his three wishes, and, you know, through the picture, you know, I give him some action. But every time he rubs himself, that's when the action happens. That's when the smoke appears. And his character's name was David Bates, okay? So my job is, as the genie, was my job to call him Master Bates. I thought that was kind of cute, too. Yeah, I had to call him Master Bates. So it just happened. He just wants to have sex with different women of, you know, of all breeds, and all he has to do is rub himself. I appear, and actually it was kind of in competition with Deep Purple at the time, I think, in the latter part of the years of Deep Purple. We did this in 71, I think. So, and the way I got casted, they described what they wanted, so I went to see, and then we had to undress, and I passed the test, and that's how I got the part. I used the word, the name Howard, okay? Some schoolmates and one of my sisters went to see that film. My name was on a billboard on top of the theater in downtown L.A. I was totally shocked. I had to go down there to see this. My guy went to school, called me, told me to come see it. But my sister had already seen the film, and then she had told my mom, and then I had to explain it. But my mom didn't want me to hear an explanation why my sister was in that kind of a movie. That's what I wanted to hear. But I never got the truth on that. So I was mislaid, and everybody else was getting laid, okay?
So did you just audition for Ebar? And what was your experience working on the project?
I actually read for the, there's a drunk in the alley, you know, trying to get away from getting a ticket, I guess, and then the cops jump up on the wall, and they shoot him and plant a gun on him. But that was the part that I read for and got. So I left here, and I helped a girlfriend of mine drive back to Cleveland because her mom was real sick. since I had gotten the part and I hadn't heard from those guys, I started to doing Mice and Men, the show both theater and Memphis, Cleveland. We were 4 days into the run, up to the play, and I get this call from these guys doing this film, and said they want me, and he asked me where I was, and I told him where I was. He said, well, we want you to come back and do the lead part. I said, the lead part to what? I didn't know who, what they were talking about. So he said, the name of the movie then was called Super Black. The name has changed a few times since then. It was called Super Black. When they made this outfit, they made an outfit for me to wear, and it had SB on the chest for Super Black. And I told them, and I said, you know what, man, ain't nobody going to call me Super Black. If they don't call me son of a bitch, I know I'm not crazy. I know I'm crazy. Or somebody will start saying that. That's automatic. So they changed, they stopped the shoot, and we started all over again. I don't know why they did all that, but we did it anyway. And that was it. It was my first, and it was just about everyone involved, it was their first as on a film. The director, Frank Packard, he's actually the great-grandson of the Packard family. And he's still alive. We and him are still friends. And he was a commercials director before he directed it. But there were some things that went on, man, in that production they said we can write a book about that. I'll tell you about a little bit about the crew right quick. They had hired a guy to do the sound, okay? We were on the outside doing an outside shot, and we're waiting for the sound man to get ready. And this guy is standing in a puddle of water trying to plug all his equipment in. Nobody could believe it. And he was having problems, but nothing really happened to him. So we thought this guy was blessed. Another scene where we had to shoot into at a computer room upstairs on Wilson Boulevard here. And again, he was the sound man. Something, he blew out the entire floor. His hair was on fire. And we talking Afro days, okay? His hair was on fire, and nobody would touch him. Everybody was scared to touch him. So the director was hollering, said, somebody jump on him. So everybody hollered back, you jump on him. So he did, and nothing happened to him. But that was another thing that happened while we were shooting this film. The script, I thought the concept was real good about the script. AIP, and when we finished this film, I'm going to jump around a little bit here, Mike. AIP was going to release this film. I signed up for deferred payment, which I never got paid, of course, but man, I don't know if you want to mention that or not. Ain't nobody going to pay me. But his rights had been sold or something. So all the crew was getting paid. They weren't getting full pay, but they were all getting paid. So I was working for free, except for getting meals. We shot in the LA area and over here, and I'm not sure what they call that. They changed the name of it. Exclusive neighborhood, but the scene was shot at the house and the motorcycles coming down the hill to the house, to the doctor's house. We shot it here in L.A., the concept was good. I liked the concept. I just thought, we didn't have much money. They had to bring in some people from the street to put the money up. I didn't meet all those people, so I'm not sure who they all were. I knew some poor guys who was in the motorcycle clubs. I went to school with some of them. We thought we was going to get them a chance to fly. And it didn't, so that's why that was the other reason why I had to get out of that first suit, because it looked like he was going to be flying around or something. He wasn't going to really be flying. He was just going to straighten out the neighborhood. I don't know how they came up with the name of A-Bar, and my name was Tobar, and how that hooked up. That was just ironic. That just happened.
Were you pleased with how the movie turned out?
I thought it was a good concept. I just didn't think it came off like it really wanted to, I think it could have came off better. But I've gotten some great, comments about the film, so I can't argue with what people like. I mean, I like because I liked it too. But like I said, we could have done some things better, especially when you're always getting attention, especially when you're doing exteriors, outdoors, and all that kind of stuff. And most of the extras in the film were friends of mine because we all started out together, and they were friends of mine. So I knew that they could deal with that material and not worry about being worried about, I was relaxed all the time doing it. I really was. I didn't have any problem with it. I was glad that it was a film with a bunch of vulgar language and, a lot of, sex type stuff during that time. It was pretty hard to get past that stuff, the pimps, and even though they showed a pimp in there, the pimp didn't do anything except with that constructed as a pimp, that's for sure. They let that little skinny woman beat his butt.
Do you have a favorite scene in the film?
I love the story about cowboy thing.
Stand back, you yellow belly coward. No black belly slave got the nerve to shoot a white man.
If I have to shoot, it's going to be right between the eyes.
No slave is that good. I say we take him.
You honkies want this land?
I say that no ex-slave will ever own one grain of dirt in this state.
All right, boys. In a few seconds, you better mount your horses and ride out of here. Otherwise, you better make a move.
Stay where you are, man.
The only way you honkies are going to get this land is to be buried on it.
Lord, have mercy. Thanks, friend. I guess they'll take care of those scum.
Yeah, well, for now. But there'll be others.
Say, you're pretty good with those shooting irons. Where you from?
No place special. Guess I'll be moving on.
Oh, sorry, I didn't get the name.
My friends call me Deadwood Dick. But my enemies call me Smart Black Nigger.
We have fronted. Yeah, I think that might have been the spot where I had the most fun myself, because it just came off, better than I thought we even did it, okay? We're talking like, you know, 9 bullets and 8 people dying, and I remember coming down the hill on that horse. I forgot to do me a test run, you know? And I got down to the bottom of that hill, and there was a fence there. Of course, the horse saw it before I did. And he came to a complete stop, and bam, over the fence I went. I wasn't even sure if I was going to get up.
So what about other African-American superhero films? Did you see Meteor Man?
Yeah, the Meteor Man, all that stuff sucked.
As an African-American actor, did you look down on the blaxploitation genre?
Well, I didn't look down on those type of movies. That would have been way out of line, too, for me. I just knew that there was something better that could be done. I always felt that. Because I was not always in a circle where everybody had a vulgar mouth, or all the women were whores, and the guys were pimps and killers, and, you know, every ethnic has good sides and bad sides. At the time that the exploitation thing was going on, it was just what everybody was going to see, you know, and of course the actors, and including myself, was glad to work. You know, a lot of times I was glad to work, man. You know, I remember being too tall when I was, being too short, too dark, not too light enough. That was some of the excuses, but I don't think that was all, you know, up on the truth myself.
Wasn't AIP involved with ABAR as well?
Yeah. American International Films was going to, distribute the movie. Now, they were also going to pay all of us off who hadn't gotten paid, plus the lab costs for the film. But this guy who played the doctor got to be a jerk, and he wanted more money before anybody else did anything. And, you know, he was like me. He wasn't getting paid. He was already walking on the side of his shoes. He maybe just should have asked for the shoes, because we'd already signed contracts and agreed to what we're going to do. So anyway, AIP backed out because this guy kept raising hell. So we didn't get paid. None of us got paid. We didn't get, AIP was also going to put up $250,000 for a sequel and bring in another director. But they really liked what they were talking like you're talking to me today, American International Pictures was. So we lost out on that. We could have had the initial, then we could have had the sequel, and, you know, who knows? Because you get better every time you work, you know.
And the actor that played the doctor in the film, J. Walter Smith, did he have something to do with the script?
Yeah, he had something to do with the writing. He had something to do with the changing of the writing. We had been at home rehearsing and doing our thing and taking a good night's sleep, come back the next day, and the script's been changed. Yeah, that was not a good thing to happen.
Do you know if the director, Frank Packard, is he still around?
He went back into it because he was a director, writer, commercial shooter. He did do some writing. He sold some scripts. And he also filled in some acting parts as well from some cowboy films. But he mainly went into writing. And then he went into construction after he walked away from everything. So he's building houses and getting ready to retire from that. I saw him yesterday. We make sure we watch all the Laker games together.
So when the film was released, I know that this was before the days of wide release. Did you travel around as it made its way around the States? And how was the movie received?
Well, I was only at the so-called premiere. This was at the Wilton Theater. And it was a good amount of people in there. The Wilton Theater is pretty popular. I actually don't know how it did in the film, in the theaters, because I was on the Chitlin' Circuit with the film. And where we stopped and places we stopped, we was on the, in the South, of course, but then it was well receptive. And then one morning we ended up on Good Morning Memphis, come to think of it. I was on Good Morning Memphis when we were showing it and getting ready to show it in Tennessee. So where we were going in the South was good. I don't know how the Midwest or the coast, either the coast did. I never learned. I didn't even know the film had been still going until I came. I left here and was down in Georgia for a while, in Texas. When I came back, and I came back in the fall of 98, and I got to doing a show over at Odyssey Theater called The Greeks. And so my picture was in the LA Times on the calendar section, and I didn't know that was happening. So a friend of mine called me, Frank Thacker called me and told me that. He said, you got to see the calendar section. You have your pictures, because they had taken some pictures of us rehearsing at the end of the show. But the very next week, A-Ball came out as it was called In Your Face. Because somebody called me and asked me, did you ever do a movie In Your Face? I said, no, I ain't done a movie name In Your Face. See what I'm saying? So I didn't know what they were talking about. But he said, man, it's your name. It says starring you, man. I said, okay, well, if you say so, well, then you got to look it up, because that's not the title I did. So and so then they started selling cassettes after that. So I'm feeling that whoever was tied in with the production at the time and saw that thing in the newspaper about me doing the Greeks down at the Odyssey Theater, took advantage of that, and all of a sudden we were selling $25 videos. And I said, wait a minute, people are selling stuff and making money, and I ain't got paid yet. I still haven't gotten paid.
We'll be back in just another minute with more from the projection booth.
Ahoy, mateys. This is KAB, Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. I'm still waiting to hear from that weatherman. But in the meantime, stay here with me. Be sure to visit our sponsor, Paracinema Magazine. They're the source for all your genre movie needs. Check them out online at paracinema.net. Tell them Stevie sent you. Keep me turned on for a while, and I'll do my best to do the same for you.
The smooth sound. Fabulous 1340 KAB.
This is Steve Railsback, and I'm in the projection booth with Mike and Justin.
The potion released from my soul at ancient wisdom.
What do you intend to do with your power?
My powers are of a divine origin.
Are you of a divine nature?
I can assure you I am.
Well, how does this power of yours apply?
I'm only a tool, Doctor. A mirror, reflecting man onto himself. By control of the mind, I can hasten the retributive forces lodged in his unconscious mind.
I had suspicions it would work that way. Something wrong?
No, no. To further relieve you, Doctor, if I misuse these powers, they can turn against me.
Misuse? Well, how?
Selfish gains. Personal power.
Well, how would that affect you?
A temporary loss of power and its devastating reactions. It's sin to nature. Anyway, I must leave.
Oh, no, there's much to...
I'll be back. Your house is about to be blown to smithereens.
Is it true that you never got paid for your performance in A-Bar?
Yeah, that's a shame, man, because, I was there regularly. You know, I came when they wanted me. I came when they claimed they wanted me, and they didn't. I was on time all the time, but I thought this was pretty exciting. Everybody else was as well. You know, and I signed a contract for $13,000 in 1974. I no longer have it now, but I had it up until a few years ago. $13,000. What do you think that'd be worth today? $750,000 or $500,000? And I know this guy sold the rights. His name is Smalley. He sold the rights, from what I was told, because I hired an entertainment lawyer to find it. Couldn't track it for a certain while until he wanted more money. I said, okay, well, forget it. I just wanted to know. So he was from Texas. I would imagine he might have a Ponderosa down there in Texas somewhere. I don't know if he sold all the rights. I doubt if he would have done that. Probably sold part of the rights, but I don't know how much of that that is. So, there was some stuff we didn't that went down that shouldn't have gone down, you know.
So I know that you were listed as being in John Carpenter's Escape from New York, but I don't ever remember seeing you.
Yeah, I did. I don't think they kept it all, though. They did for a while. One of the Indians, I know they didn't, but this particular scene, because what happened was the Indians got a hold of the glider, and we chopped it up. And I don't think that's been in the film since a long time. It might have been in the first run, and that was it. Yeah, but see, we actually chopped it up. Me and two other guys, we played in it. We were playing Mohican Indians. Yeah, we looked like Indians. That's for sure. Maybe he didn't like it the way it came out. I don't know. Never talked to him again after that. But I know he was happy about it when we shot it. Yeah, if it hadn't been for Isaac Hayes, I would have had that part. My name wasn't big enough, you know. Well, that's according to John. He talked pretty a lot to me, when I auditioned for that film. He was pulling my weight. He wasn't quite sure how the executives were going to go, but he was pulling my way. I gave him credit for that. I had a chance to work for him again, but then I was down in Texas doing something else. So that was my last shot with him, too.
Could you tell me a little bit more about your theater group?
You know, I'm also the co-founder of a theater group. We had our 25th anniversary about 3 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago. So we're about 27, 28 years old. It's just me and Will Salmon. He's the actual founder and the director. And done a lot of performances in those years. Our very first performance, though, was over in Tokyo, Japan. So we were just doing movie stuff and storytelling at the time. It was just three of us. It was me, Will, and our female dancer, who retired. She retired from our group, but we still love her. And so it was just the three of us went over there at the time. We were well received, and we came home and tried to show it off. But like I said, we were just into movement stuff and storytelling and dancing. So it wasn't like a three-act play or something, you know. We do performances and let everybody go home early. And so Tokyo, Japan was our first production.
So who do you think would win in a fight, A-Bar or Superman?
Oh, I'd kick his butt. Yeah, Superman needs a good butt whipping. Kryptonite. Yeah, without his kryptonite, I'd kick his butt. Let me put it like that.
So, Mike, this week you chose the film. So I was just curious to see why you chose such a random and obscure black exploitation film for your pick.
Yeah, normally I think I would probably go with films that I've seen 100 times and have loved and feel that are neglected by the public at large. But when I finally saw A-Bar, it just absolutely blew my mind. It was so rough around the edges and so blindingly sincere with this message. I mean, any movie that has the Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream speech on it, not once, not twice, but at least three times, with posters of Martin Luther King on the background, and deals with just absolutely crazy scenarios, blew my mind when I saw it. And it continues to every time that I rewatch it.
There's totally a gratuitous amount of Martin Luther King in it. The Martin Luther King Jr. is very gratuitous in the film. I actually have only seen the film three times now, but I do enjoy it, actually. I feel like it's a little long, but I actually think that Tobey Armeo is fabulous in it. You know, you and I have talked off mic. You know, I think it's a very sincere film as well, and I think its message is pure and honest, and I think it it actually addresses a real important issue that was going on back in the 70s in terms of just how the melting pot was becoming mixed.
Yeah, the film definitely is, it's clunky. It does get long. The first time I watched it in chunks, and I think that's probably the best way to watch it. The three-act structure is completely in play in this film. The turning points are like these huge red flags in there. We should probably talk a little bit about the movie. It starts with a moving van coming into this neighborhood, which is all white. And it is such an uproar that a black family is moving into this neighborhood that they actually broadcast it on the radio. Attention, there is racial strife going on. And the neighbors are all out and they're protesting. They've got their placards. And their next door neighbor is the one who is screaming the loudest about this whole scenario. And she is just, she's dropping N-bombs all over the place. If Abar hears about this on the radio, which is great, he's hanging out with his friends, and then they all drive over on their motorcycles and they play Abar's theme song, which I know that you love. You can't get enough of it, which is great because they continuously play that. Every time that Abar is doing stuff, they will play his theme. And he shows up, tells the doc, "What are you doing in this bougie neighborhood? You should be back in the hood with us and keeping your money over there." Well, little does he know that the doctor is in this white neighborhood, I guess for privacy or something, because he's working on a very important formula. Now, if you don't know what the formula is or where it's this movie's going, then obviously you've never watched a movie before.
Right. Going back a little bit to the, you know, the protesting by the, you know, when the family moves in. Some of my favorite stuff in the film is actually right there because it's so intense and it's so, you know, such a, it's caused such an uproar that they go so far as to throw things at the house. And in different shots, you can see that they actually drop a coffin off on the front porch. And there's also like spare tires on the porch. And I was hoping to see like some antiques show up in the yard, you know, maybe some chickens. You know, there's all kinds of crazy stuff that they do. You know, I will say that the actual theme song does wear its welcome out after about 35 seconds. It literally comes on every time you see Abar enter the frame. It's really original. It's just really, it's a bizarre film. It's almost sort of comical to a certain extent. It kind of makes a Herschel Gordon Lewis movie look like a James Cameron movie.
Ah, good morning, children.
Daddy, what's wrong with Mother?
Your mother's a little upset over what happened last night and a few other things.
I can't blame her. It's such a mean and cruel thing for anyone to do.
I hate them. I hate them all. They killed our cat.
Son, you must never say that. You remember when we had our dog, Toby?
Yes, Daddy.
And how he was suffering? Well, while you were holding him, he snapped at you. Did you hate Toby for that?
No.
Well, there are all types of people with broken minds and broken hearts that need mending. And they snap at each other because of their suffering. So when someone behaves badly towards you, just think about Toby, okay?
But Daddy, why do we have to live in this neighborhood?
Because they're like Toby and Daddy is a doctor and he is going to cure them. Dad, there's a park just a few blocks away. Can I go there and play?
No, son, you better stay close to the house.
Now you remember what Daddy said, or you'll be a little boy all your life.
Oh, shut up, you Watusi Wobbler. Who cares?
Yeah, I think a lot of the comedy comes out of just the really poor performances, and that they're all overdubbed doesn't help things either. Joe Barmeo seemed to be the only one with any kind of real experience on this in this production, and he seemed to be very professional at this level. I mean, it was his first starring role. He seemed to be very into the idea of, here I am, I'm starring in this film. But the guy who played Dr. Kincaid, J. Walter Smith, gives a really, really clunky, halting performance. And even in the overdubs, it still comes through how poorly he acts. And it doesn't help that everything that he says is very portentous. So it's putting a lot of importance on all of the words that he is saying. And that just makes it even more stilted. And then the kids, they have some interesting exchanges, and they're all overdubbed, of course, too. It's almost like watching a Japanese movie dubbed in English, but you're watching an American movie dubbed into bad acting, basically.
Did you catch the scene with Whitey planting the bomb, and the little African-American kid comes around the corner with a gun, and he's sitting there talking, and there's actually no dialogue coming from his mouth?
That is great. But going back to your talk about all of the stuff being thrown onto Dr. Kincaid's lawn, I like that when Abar shows up with his gang, that he just has the one guy like pick up the yard, and he even yells at him to move faster. It's like, this poor guy, you know, he's out there having to clean up, you know, the coffin and the chickens and the tires and all this stuff. And it's like, you know, hey man, come on, step it up, would you? You know, obviously with the title like Abar the First Black Superman, you know that at some point he's going to be a Superman. And the way that his powers are shown and what he does with his powers is beyond anything else that was happening, at least with the black exploitation genre at the time. He cleans up the neighborhood in a very unexpected way.
And it also shows you that with Packard's direction, you can make Superman, you can make anyone a Superman basically by having a close-up of their eyes and playing the film in reverse.
A reverse and even in fast motion too, which there is nothing better in the world than fast motion. But I think my favorite scene of Abar's power is when the screen starts to compress and the people on screen are getting smaller and smaller. I thought that maybe he was putting them into the Phantom Zone.
One of my favorite scenes in the film actually is when Abar is hanging out with the kids in the bedroom and they're on the race car bed. The young boy wants to know about if there are any black cowboys. And so Abar commences in telling him the story about Deadwood Dick, which I think is a great sequence. I think it's poorly done. But I mean, it is, you know, it is a Western sequence in a black exploitation movie. You know, one thing that I found absolutely hilarious about Abar, and maybe we're skipping ahead a little bit, but was how he actually turned into the first black Superman, which is where the doctor actually gave him a potion that he and the doctor had judged Abar worthy person to consume the potion and fix the wrongs in society in terms of African Americans and with white people and the struggles they sometimes see.
Yeah, I love that the politics of the time were so present in this film. And I wonder, could you look at that film at the time and say, who would you give this formula to today? Would you give this to an Eldridge Cleaver or to some other Black Panther type leader? Did someone think that they were in such dire straits that they would actually need to create their own Superman? Was there such a lack of leadership that there was no one there to fill those shoes, and that they tried to fill the shoes with this fictional character of Abar to right all of the wrongs that had happened? I love, love, love that one of the people that Abar goes after is a priest, to show the excesses of the priests in the neighborhood and to turn this priest's elegant car into a horse and buggy. I found that absolutely terrific that the filmmakers had enough guts to point out that wrong in the black community.
If you think about it, you watch Abar, and then if I'm sure most people listening are very familiar with black exploitation films. I'm sure everyone's seen Coffee and Foxy Brown and all those, but Abar is really nothing like any other black exploitation film to a certain extent. Like, there are no other black exploitation films, in my experience, that touch so sincerely on that point, I think.
Yeah, to me, there are the black exploitation films that are much more mainstream. They're the, you know, they may not have been made for that much money, but they're definitely aimed at cashing in on that money. They want the Shaft money. They want the Superfly cachet. They want that kind of stuff. And they kind of ape those films. To me, the real sincere films are the ones that aren't being made and marketed just to that core audience and crossover audience that a Coffee or a Foxy Brown or a Sheba Baby could appeal to. So you look at Abar, and that's definitely not made for a mainstream audience. They may have thought that they were making it for a mainstream audience and may have thought that it was going to bust out and be this huge phenomenon. But I find that those kind of films are much more fascinating than the larger blaxploitation films. Films such as Abar, films like Big Time, which also starred Tobar Mayo, co-starred, I should say. Films like The Baron, the ones that don't immediately come to mind when you're talking about blaxploitation, don't come to the tip of your tongue. Those are the ones that I feel are much more genuine and much more worthy of being looked at and being discussed. And unfortunately, those are generally the films that are the most neglected, not only in terms of their discussion, but also in terms of how poorly they've been remastered. Are they even available on DVD? Is there a whole underbelly of films that we don't know about that would fit into this kind of category that didn't appeal to the mass audience, so they languish someplace. The other thing that we should say, you're talking about how much you liked all of the shots of Tobar's eyes and staring at the camera and the high-pitched whine and the fast-forward and the reverse action of the film is what I found the most fascinating about Tobar Mayo. And I hope that when he listens to this, he doesn't find it offensive at all. But his lack of eyebrows, either they're not there at all, or they're really light-colored, and they're just completely invisible. It's kind of that Whoopi Goldberg thing where I can't look at Whoopi without just staring at the space 1 inch above her eyes. It's just like, what happened there? So to have so many close-ups of Tobar's eyes and his eyeless brows, his browless eyes, I should say, was just, I couldn't stop staring.
I did notice that too, actually. You know, Tobar seems to have an uncanny resemblance, or actually I should say the actor Bokeem Woodbine has a natural uncanny resemblance to Tobar Mayo. They look real similar to each other. And so, yeah, I did totally notice the eyebrows. I thought it was really bizarre that they weren't there. Sorry, Tobar. I guess we should talk a little bit about Frank Packard too, because, you know, watching Abar, you can't help but get the impression that this is the man's grand vision to a certain extent. And one of my favorite scenes, probably actually my favorite scene in the film, I guess you couldn't call a scene, is just the end credit sequence with Tobar walking down the street. It feels very epic, and it feels like, you know, you're in the opening sequence from Once Upon a Time in the West, but with credits rolling up, you know. But it's still, it's a real wide shot, and he's walking down the street like he's just saved the day. And, you know, I think that's my favorite scene in the movie.
Yeah, it's completely triumphant. No matter how many times I watch it, I forget that that's how the movie ends, and I forget what a good feeling it leaves you with. And I think that that's really what they were going for with this film, was to offer some hope.
You gotta wonder if we'll ever see a sequel. More than likely not.
No, but we can hope.
Actually, before we talk more about Tobar, I wanted to ask Mike, since Mike did the interview, I wanted to see, Tobar comes across the interview as a real sincere, really nice, down-to-earth guy. I was just wondering, you know, what you thought of him when you got to interview him.
Yeah, he came across very, very nice, and it seemed like he was very happy to talk to us, and that was terrific. It was very nice to speak to him. And yeah, it seems like he's still practicing his craft. He's got his theater group that he's been working at. You know, he may not be in the limelight, but he definitely has his act together. So it was really great talking to him.
Mike and I would like to offer out a sincere thank you to Tobar Mayo for allowing us the opportunity to interview him. We'll be back in a couple minutes.
In Rocky IV, he fought for his country.
What the hell is this?
Now, Dolph Lundgren is taking off his gloves and taking on an entire army. One man at a time. Red Scorpion.
The impetus behind the rebellion is this man.
He is your targeted objective.
His one mistake meant a death sentence.
I leave you as an insult to your people. How could you fail?
Their one mistake.
We'll have a band-aid.
You're breaking my bleeding heart, Moose.
Was not finishing the job.
We will deliver our response.
This is the rebel army.
Pride of the Soviet army.
First he was their weapon. What? Now he's their punishment. They think they control him.
Let's kick some.
Think again.
Doc, you might need some help!
Dolph Lundgren, Red Scorpion.
On the break just there, you heard the audio from the trailer for the 1989 Dolph Lundgren film Red Scorpion. In a few weeks from now, we'll actually be covering the film and playing an interview we did with Dolph a few weeks back. So keep an eye out for it. Mike's gone down to the lobby to get some more popcorn, so yet again I'm forced to close out this episode. But since we're a little short on content this week, we've decided to play you a couple bonus bits. First up, we've got a never-before-heard audio reading of a selection from Mike's book, Impossibly Funky, A Cashew to Cinemart's Collection. and it's about the lost cut of the original 1977 Star Wars. The selection is read by Tim Mallows of Fifth Digit Comics. And if you'd like to check Tim out, you can visit his website at www.fifthdigit.com. And after it's over, we'll be back with a special preview of show number 3.
Impossibly Funky, a Cashier's Du Cinema collection, Star Wars, The Lost Cut, by Mike White. I have heard about the 7-hour cut of the Magnificent Ambersons that RKO butchered and burned for the nitrates. I have read about the 5-hour cut of Once Upon a Time in the West, discovered at Sergio Leone's estate after his death. I have watched alternate cuts of Heavenly Creatures, Freaked, Hard Target, Touch of Evil, and all of Terry Gilliam and James Cameron's films. I have to admit that with each unveiling of a different version of a film, I get a giddy feeling. It is not that alternate cuts are necessarily better, Blade Runner, or that extra scenes necessarily add anything of interest, 1941. Instead, these versions offer viewers a chance to witness the progression of the films from their origins to the finished product. Looking at the aforementioned films and offering up other films that have been released on video, in theater, or on television in an altered state, Amazon Women on the Moon, Superman, Jaws, Dune, The Exorcist, in other words, the fodder of feature articles for Video Watchdog, one would be hard-pressed to find another film with a history as unique and outrageous as Star Wars. Few films have been tinkered with as much since their initial release. Even before 1997's Special Edition, Star Wars underwent minor retooling, adding the subtitle Episode 4 during the preamble scroll, removing and re-adding C-3PO's The tractor beam is coupled to the main reactor in 7 locations. A power loss at one of the terminals will allow the ship to leave, and the stormtroopers open the blast doors lines. But more than inserting alternate takes and excised scenes, George Lucas created entirely new shots and changed the tone and intent of scenes. Not necessarily entirely due to budgetary and technological limits, but because Lucas had simply changed his mind about some things over the years. Lucas needs to learn to put a project to bed when the time is due. Can you imagine the mess that a director could make if his obsessive tinkering got the best of his work? What kind of damage could Orson Welles do to Citizen Kane if he were alive and decided that he really would rather have the story told in a linear fashion? Not to suggest that George Lucas should have passed on after The Empire Strikes Back, but it seems that his meddling is more damaging than helpful. What is more important than what Lucas has added to Star Wars Special Edition is what he kept out. Lucas put in the scene of Han Solo talking to Jabba the Hutt, and justified it by saying that it tied in with Jabba's appearance in Return of the Jedi. However, using that same logic, wouldn't it also have made sense to put in the early scenes in Star Wars with Biggs' Darklighter and Luke, so that Biggs' death is given the proper weight when he dies in the assault on the Death Star? Isn't this inter-film connection even more important because of Biggs' mysterious appearance on the moon of Yavin? Would it not answer the question of who this mustachioed guy is and why the music swells after his death? If there was a time to put the Biggs Darklighter scenes and others back in, Star Wars Special Edition was it. Lucas's excuse for their continued absence? They are said to detract from the pacing of the film. If that is the case, then the Wampa material and the shot of Darth Vader's shuttle returning to a Star Destroyer in the Empire Strikes Back Special Edition should never have been shot and crudely stuffed into that film. So what is the truth for why these scenes remain out of the public eye? The last decade has seen 4 major releases of the Star Wars trilogy: the Definitive Collection, the Digitally Remastered Collection, and the Special Editions theatrical and subsequent video releases. It seems that Lucas's marketing strategy is a combination of Disney's release and withdraw scheme and his old pal Francis Ford Coppola's re-edit and release ploy that he's been using for years with the Godfather films. The Complete Godfather, The Godfather Epic, The Digitally Remastered Godfather, etc. As long as there is a dime to squeeze out of the Star Wars franchise, Lucas is going to do it. And the best way to milk a cash cow is to dole out extras every few years. In this way, Lucas will continue to release various versions of Star Wars in various formats well into the next millennium. What could the future of Star Wars re-releases hold? The Lucasfilm archives contain a treasure trove of material that may or may not ever see the light of a projector bulb again. Sure, there are plenty of embarrassing moments. The Star Wars Holiday Special is proof of that. It's not that Jefferson Starship's stunning performance of Light the Sky on Fire really adds to the overall history of Star Wars, but the special played host to the introduction of Boba Fett through the cartoon that Chewbacca's son Waru watched. Moreover, the Life on Tatooine sequence contains shots that were originally in Star Wars, but not released in any other format. When an alternate cut of Howard Hawks' The Big Sleep was re-released in 1998, audiences were made privy to a view of an American classic in progress. There is a myriad of reasons why this event was not widely heralded. The Big Sleep had a small re-release and virtually no marketing, especially when compared to another classic film noir that had a revival that same year, Touch of Evil. Moreover, if The Big Sleep is famous for anything, it's for its convoluted plot, begging the question of why it wasn't as big of a draw as a film directed by the wine guy. In both cases, however, the stories of both these films' discoveries and re-releases were hot news among cinephiles, and even made waves in the mainstream media. Try to imagine another film that, if an alternate version were unearthed, might have more significance than Star Wars. News of this kind could generate enough hype that it might even overshadow the fervor that The Phantom Menace has created. Being more than a new chapter in the Star Wars story, another version of Star Wars would put the original film in a new light, enriching its history and giving us a glimpse into the creation of this cultural phenomenon. Instead of burning up the internet, at the time this story was written, few folks have heard the news. There is a lost cut of Star Wars. I still find it difficult to believe that the write-up of the lost cut was delegated to the back of the Star Wars Insider number 41 instead of being the cover story. So, what's different about the lost cut? It's a given that the scenes of Luke watching the battle between the Rebel blockade runner and Star Destroyer, Luke at Tashi Station, and the original Jabba the Hutt scenes are in place. It's not too much of a stretch of the imagination to know that most of the special effects shots are a lot rougher, as rear projection was used instead of blue screen shots. It's also very interesting that there are alternate takes in which familiar lines are said but with different inflections. But when looking at the lost cut, the most startling thing is that the film has an entirely different tone than the version that has become an integral part of American culture. According to David West Reynolds' Revolution of Star Wars, geography plays a much larger role in the lost cut. Viewers get a real sense of the layout of both Tatooine and the Death Star. This, in addition to a larger cast of minor characters and longer, more realistically paced scenes, gives the film a much more documentary-like feel, putting it in line with Lucas's previous feature, American Graffiti, and its quasi-documentary style. Will this version ever be readily available to the public? I think one would have a better chance at getting a full Warren Commission report and President Kennedy's brain than getting Lucas to ever release the lost cut, as it doesn't match his artistic vision. I hope that Lucas can see the importance of preserving a part of filmic history and eventually allows it to be studied. The original version of this article ran in Cashiers Do Cinemart, number 9.
Okay, up next we have a special sneak preview into next week's episode. We'll be covering in detail the 1974 Joseph Sargent directed The Taking of Pelham 123, as well as playing back our interview with Chris Gore, creator of Film Threat magazine and co-host of the G4 Network's Attack of the Show. So without delaying, here's a piece of the interview with Chris, where we discussed, and ever so timely I may note, Charlie Sheen. Sure, we'll cash in on the media hype as well. So, Chris, when do you think you're going to interview Charlie Sheen?
I would love to. I think what's weird is he sounded so crazy and all that other stuff, you know, some of the other interviews. And then he was on Stern the other day and he sounded coherent. The guy, I don't know, I kind of admire the guy. Like, I really feel that the reason he's being crucified in the media is because we're fucking pussies. You know, men have become pussies. You know, he's really living the life that, you know, if guys had balls these days, yeah, we'd fuck whores and drink and do drugs all the time. But we got to look sensitive. Definitely become like the pussification of America. And I think that Charlie Sheen looks crazy because he's not that. And, you know, that kind of admire him for living the life and being like, fuck it, this is what I do. I never signed a morality clause when I do this show. Does the show, he does the job. And I think he's got a feel, and he's definitely stood up for the people who are not getting paid on that show. I would love to interview him, although I have had a brush with Charlie Sheen. And what's odd is that he's had all these bad influences on his life, right? Like, he's had drug dealers that have influenced him, porn stars. I actually helped Charlie Sheen be recognized as a good citizen. I don't know if you know this story. Back in the day, back in the 90s, you know, when VHS was king, never came out that I was the guy, but I had become friends with a film director named Adam Rifkin. And at the time, Charlie Sheen was in his movie, The Chase. So I'd met Charlie Sheen, super nice guy, whatever. I became sort of his dealer for weird videos, whether it was hentai porn from Japan, Legend of the Overfiend, and whatnot. I was really Charlie Sheen's dealer for weird video. And I had lent him a film that was called Guinea Pig. Now, as you're well aware, Guinea Pig is a fake snuff film. It's a snuff film. A guy basically disembowels and almost does a live autopsy on a woman who dies. Now, to me, looking at it, it's like, yes, this is really cheesy effects. It's very Grand Guignol type of stuff. Not my thing. I'm not a big fan of the gore. He wanted the most extreme, hardcore stuff, and there was nothing more extreme or hardcore than this film, Guinea Pig. I lent Charlie Sheen the VHS tape of Guinea Pig, and it freaked him the fuck out. He was fucking freaked out from this video. He proceeds from this tape to contact me to say, look, what's up with this? I say, it's fake. It's fake. He told his friend who's in the FBI about this film because he said, look, a woman dies in this movie. I said, no, it's fake. He says, no, you've got to be interrogated by the FBI, which is now my second encounter with the FBI, actually. The first came about when I interviewed John Hinckley from prison. And I had written John Hinckley in prison and asked him very innocently, I'm a teenager at the time, would you mind reviewing Taxi Driver for my underground fanzine Film Threat? He wrote a letter back and said, I can't really say much, but, and then proceeded to give me his thoughts on Taxi Driver, which I published in then the underground version of Film Threat magazine, which got all sorts of national attention, which happened to get me on an FBI watch list. Because if you do correspond with someone who's tried to assassinate the president of the United States and become friends with them, you'll be on a watch list.
Good to know.
I spoke with Charlie Sheen's buddy, who was in the FBI, about this film and pleaded with him, this is fake. I'm sorry. If you look at this, you know, the blood is fake. No, he said he was having people, like these sort of video forensic guys, look at this video to examine it, but he wanted to know the source and was not going to let me away unless I gave the source. I mean, he was not going to let me go, like not going to let me, you've got to reveal the source, which is a guy named Chaz Ballin. And he's going to tell you exactly the same thing he told me. It's fake. Well, unbeknownst to me, this guy Chaz is like a big dealer of marijuana. And any contact with the authorities coming via me sounds like I ratted him out. I ratted him out because it's like, hey, he's the guy I got the videotape from. Later, he turned out to be a real scumbag because he was actually bootlegging videos that I was legally selling in the United States because I had gotten deals with filmmakers who I paid residuals to. But he was bootlegging our videos and selling them. We got in a fight at some horror convention. And the guy's a big bike guy. He's like 6'5", 100 pounds on me, easy at the time. And he proceeds to, one of his toadies came up and tried to start some kind of conflict between the two of us. And he tried to pour a beer on me, but was great as I deflected it with my arm, which the beer landed all over his toady, which was great. But I just stood my ground and said, look, dude, you're selling movies that I have the rights to. I, on a, I think it was quarterly basis, would write check to filmmakers like Richard Kern and Jörg Butgerett in Germany and Todd Phillips, you know, now a big filmmaker in Hollywood. I was distributing his movies legally in the United States. And this guy was bootlegging them. Fucker. You're taking money out of my pocket, pirating those movies. Long and the short of it was, a big story came out on Hard Copy about this Charlie Sheen thing, that he was being recognized by the FBI as a good citizen for having turned in the snuff film, which was my video. I never got it back. But it was in all the media in the early 90s that he was recognized. It was on Hard Copy. It was on all these shows. My name was never mentioned, and I never got the tape back. I like to think I sent him on his dark path. So fuck you, Charlie.
Thanks for listening to episode 2 of The Projection Booth. We hope you enjoyed the show. The DVD for A-Bar, The First Black Superman, is currently available from Xenon Releasing and can be purchased through their website or via Amazon.com. If you like the audio portion of Mike's book, you can purchase an actual print copy over at his official website or via Amazon.com as well. Mike's official website is ImpossiblyFunky.com. And also don't forget to rate this podcast on iTunes, and be sure to check out our official website at www.projection-booth.com. Now, as you head down to your seats, we'll leave you with some walking music. After all, every superhero has to have their own theme music, right? Here's mine. Enjoy.
The party was jumping when Bertha got off of her stump. The whistles were blowing and everybody did the bump. But all the time, Bertha had been working on a goodie. Now folks call it the Bertha Butt Boogie.
When Bertha Butt did a goodie, she
Questions.